Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. On today's show, we'll hear two interviews connected with the controversial Tams Supermax prison in southern Illinois and a campaign involving community art which worked to raise awareness of the prison. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The volume is getting louder in the fight for more local community radio. Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit upheld a Federal Communications Commission ruling that protects low-power FM stations from encroachment when a full-power station tries to move into the same airwaves being used by a low-power one. Parul Desai, vice president of the Media Access Project, who represented the Prometheus Radio Project in the case, explains that low-power FM stations, or LPFMs, have always had secondary status to full-power stations.
So if a full-power station wants to move into a community where a LPFM already exists, the LPFM is required to move to make room for the full-power station so the full-power station doesn't suffer from any interference.
This means that LPFMs have only two options: move or get off the air. But options for where to move are limited. In December of 2007, the FCC passed a rulemaking that would allow LPFMs to relocate to a nearby empty channel where LPFMs hadn't been allowed, a move which prompted the National Association of Broadcasters, known as the NAB, to sue the FCC.
Last week, the court finally decided the case between the NAB and the FCC, and the D.C. Circuit found that the FCC correctly interpreted the statute and so dismissed the NAB's petition.
And this week, the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Communications Technology and the Internet held a hearing on the Local Community Radio Act, a bill that would expand the number of LPFM radio stations across the country. Representative Michael Doyle of Pennsylvania called on Congress to pass the legislation and end inconsistent rules that prevent new community-oriented LPFM stations from using the so-called third adjacent channel, the spot three clicks on the dial away from an existing station. While LPFMs have been banned, translators that repeat commercial radio signals have been allowed to broadcast.
What we call Rose by any other name would smell as sweet, but when it comes to FCC and the big broadcasters, this name is critical. Translators that serve the interest of big broadcasters work just fine on these third adjacent channels, and there's no complaints and no issues about interference. I just hope once and for all we can sort of eliminate this double talk that's been taking place for years.
Cheryl Lianza of the United Church of Christ, which advocates for LPFM, testified that this is not about issues of interference, but about incumbents protecting their territory.
Incumbents do not have a sterling track record when it comes to technical questions about new entrants. Whether it was the AM radio broadcasters trying to keep out that newfangled FM service in the 1930s, or it was Ma Bell telling you that it was absolutely impossible for you to buy a telephone in a store and hook it up to the network without causing the entire network to fall down, incumbents protect their territory, and this situation is no different.
Andrew Emmett, a high school senior in Knoxville, Tennessee, was looking on the internet for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered-related sites. He was trying to research scholarship money. But he discovered that LGBT websites were being blocked by his school system. So, along with two other students and a librarian, he went to the American Civil Liberties Union and filed a lawsuit. The schools in Knox County and more than 100 other Tennessee school districts, including metropolitan Nashville, have been using internet filtering software provided by Education Networks of America to block some LGBT sites. Catherine Crump of the ACLU is a lead attorney on the case.
It was impossible to access the websites of civil rights organizations advocating the fair treatment of gays and lesbians, but it was possible to access websites suggesting that people could change their sexuality through prayer.
The ACLU calls this type of blocking, quote, viewpoint discrimination, which allows access to one side of the debate while forbidding access to the other side of the debate.
Schools teach students the wrong lessons when they react to speech that they don't necessarily support by blocking access to that speech. We live in a democratic society where there's supposed to be a free exchange of ideas, especially about important political questions, and to simply block access to one side of a debate is out of step with that tradition.
Within a few weeks of filing the lawsuit, the Tennessee schools unblocked the sites. And in a surprise move, several Indiana schools that also use Education Networks of America to filter their networks also unblocked LGBT sites.
The ACLU is just really pleased that our clients are going to be able to have access to these websites when they go back to school. It's just nice that the schools, you know, although it may have taken a little encouragement, have decided to do the right thing and to unblock these websites. So this is a real success and a great victory from our point of view.
Although they are happy with the outcome and hope that the schools will continue to allow access to the LGBT sites, the ACLU has not withdrawn the lawsuit. They are waiting for an agreement in writing from the school district that they will not reblock the site. Crump hopes the students will contact the ACLU if they discover that their schools are blocking websites too.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The rush to the right among black politicians is led by corporate-bought scoundrels seeking statewide office. It marks a new low in black politics. In fact, the rash of right-wing black candidacies represents an affront to the very idea of a politics that is accountable to the black public. Instead, we are confronted with a new class of corporate connivers that measure black progress by the candidate's success in garnering white votes by any shameful means necessary. In this retrograde process, the black public is expected to support the corporate black candidate for reasons of race loyalty. They are taken for granted, as if in the candidate's pocket, while he caters to every whim and prejudice of white voters. It is a profoundly degrading exercise, utterly contemptuous of the black public, which is precisely why a growing number of white people are feeling so good about the phenomenon. They get to decide which kinds of black politicians rise to state and national prominence. The latest crop of ambitious right-wing black higher office seekers includes Arthur Davis, the congressman from Alabama who rode to victory over progressive incumbent Earl Hilliard on a wave of corporate and Zionist money back in 2002. Ever since, Davis has consistently been part of a cluster of derelict corporate water carriers at the absolute bottom of every report card issued by the watchdog group Congressional Black Caucus Monitor. When former Memphis Congressman Harold Ford Jr. left the House to run for the U.S. Senate, Davis took his place as the worst member of the CBC, its least progressive member, which, I suppose, is Congressman Davis's top qualification as a Democratic candidate for governor of the state of Alabama. He can prove to the powers that be that he sits to the right of almost every other black member of Congress. As a black star in the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which represents the corporate class in the Democratic Party, Arthur Davis is well connected. Former Congressman, now White House Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, took young Davis under his wing and put him in charge of recruiting black candidates for Congress in the Southeast. Davis's old buddy, Harold Ford, is now chairman of the DLC, so Davis can count on corporate money pouring into his gubernatorial campaign. The corporate media love him, which is more proof of his worthlessness to black people. Next door, in Georgia, another throwback to Booker T. Washington's time is also running for governor. Thurbert Baker is currently state attorney general. His top campaign issue is crime, and he takes credit for passage of a two-strikes-you're-out mandatory life imprisonment law. There's actually a small herd of right-wing Negroes aspiring to high statewide office. They represent a total waste of the black community's time and resources spent nurturing their careers. As my grandmother would say, all these years we've just been fattening frogs for snakes. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature two interviews connected with the controversial Tams Supermax prison in southern Illinois and a campaign involving community art which worked to raise awareness of the prison. The following interviews were recorded on Friday, June 5th, 2009. We are recording. We are speaking with
Jesse Graves.
And you are involved with
The Tams 10-year campaign.
You're involved also in particular with a medium of art that you've actually claimed to claim the fame as having invented. What's the medium, and tell us a little bit of how you invented it.
Well, the medium is mud, and I'm just using it as my material to express my messages. I started mud stenciling as a way to solve the problem of how to put environmentally conscious messages in public spaces without using toxic substances. What I'm doing here is I'm using earth, the material that sustains us, to offer solutions to how we can sustain ourselves.
Walk us through with how a mud stencil would actually work.
Well, I dig up some dirt and I pour some water in it, mix it up with a kitchen whisk in a bucket, and then I use my stencil that I have designed and cut to either hold up or tape to the outside of a building or lay down on a sidewalk, and then I just sponge the mud on that and lift it up. The material, I began using Mylar, which is like a thin plastic. I reuse some pieces that I use for screen printing. You can use it for registration. And
that's for the medium of the stencil.
Yeah, that's okay. For the stencil. So that's what I was cutting them out of. But then I also found I can use x-rays too. Pet x-rays specifically. You can't use human ones. Right.
So the film used for x-rays
can also
be used for the stencils.
Yeah, it's great because it's thick and it doesn't absorb water. So that I use for the smaller ones. For the larger ones, I've been using tar paper, which is put under shingles to keep water out.
What are some of the stencils that you or others have made?
Well, I mean, you can go to my website. It's mudstencils.com and see all of my designs. There's definitely more to come. My personal ones focus on environmental messages because it's mud, it's earth, that's the medium that makes sense. For this design isn't my logo. This is part of the TAMS 10-year campaign. So we are using it to raise awareness with this horrible prison.
And describe the logo, please.
Well, it's an outline of the state of Illinois, and it says "End Torture in Illinois," with a star marking the location of the Tams prison.
How long have you been making mud stencils?
For 2.5 years now.
And what inspired you to invent the medium?
Well, I was actually taking a class where I had to make a stencil. It was called Guerrilla Printmaking, and we used very simple printmaking techniques to get messages in public spaces. For every assignment, we had to get our work out there. And it didn't necessarily have to be posting in the street. We could put it in a gallery or post it online somewhere. So we had to make the stencil, and typically people use spray paint for stencils. You can also use spray chalk or, figure something else out. And like I said earlier, I decided to use mud to solve the solution of how to get these environmental messages in public spaces.
How popular is the medium?
Whenever anyone hears about it, they're definitely interested, and I think it's surprising for a lot of people. You don't expect to see mud on walls, but so that's been working for me.
Have folks placed these in like public spaces or on sidewalks, or where would I be most likely to find a mud stencil?
I mean, I don't know where other people place them. I like to get permission first to ask a local business, maybe, because I mean that way. For me, street art is about the community that it goes in. I want it to be something that the people who look at it every day are going to enjoy. So I want to have that support, and it's also going to stay up longer that way. I mean, I'm not opposed to just going and putting things up, because I think that people do have a right to public space. Public space, if you're paying for it with your taxes, that's your space. And I personally believe that you then have a right to use it.
And if for folks who want to learn more about the medium and how to make mud stencils, what can they do?
Well, you can go to my website, just mudstencils.com. I have directions on there. But, you know, it's pretty straightforward. Like, you just design your stencil, cut it out, mix up some mud, and sponge it on.
Thank you very much. Could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Lori Jo Reynolds, and I'm with the TAMS Year 10 campaign.
We had heard from Jesse about a mud stencil campaign that's involved to help to highlight the TAMS Supermax prison in Illinois. I imagine not a lot of people, perhaps maybe not a lot of Illinois residents, know about TAMS. What is TAMS?
TAMS is a supermax prison, which is in the very tip of southern Illinois, and it's a prison where all the prisoners are kept in permanent solitary confinement. The only time they leave their cell is to take a shower or to exercise alone in basically a concrete pen. And they are not allowed phone calls, they're not allowed contact visits, and there's no educational rehabilitative opportunities at TAMS.
This sounds, well, folks who hear this might think it sounds really extreme, and they imagine that it would be reserved only for the most heinous or brutal criminals in our society. Is that the case?
Well, nobody is sentenced to TAMS because of the severity of their crime. So there are people there with serious crimes, definitely. But nobody is sent there for that reason. They're supposed to be sent there if they're disruptive or violent in a regular Illinois prison. And that's one of the problems at TAMS Supermax. Right now, there's no clear criteria about why somebody is sent from a regular prison to TAMS Supermax prison. And there's also no criteria or procedures for how they would get out of the Supermax. It was initially supposed to be a short-term shock treatment behavior modification program. So the prisoners that were sent there were only supposed to be there for 1 or 2 years. And at this point, one-third of the prisoners at TAMS have been in this extreme isolation, which is also called cold storage, for over a decade. So clearly there's a problem with the criteria and procedures.
And what have been some of the things that the TAMS Year 10 campaign has done to try to correct this situation?
Well, one of the first things that the TAMS Year 10 campaign had to do was let members of the public know about what was happening at TAMS. Because the prisoners are not allowed phone calls, and because it is in the very southern part of the state, most people just have never even heard of the prison and didn't know anything about it, including members of the legislature. So we started our campaign at the 10-year anniversary of the opening of the Supermax.
And when was that?
It opened in 1998. And so we started our campaign in 2008 at that anniversary. And we held about 40 different artistic, cultural, and political events in order to let people know about TAMS. And at these events, we had ex-prisoners speak, people who are experts in torture, and attorneys who have litigated on behalf of TAMS prisoners. And, you know, when the public heard about this, and most people, when they hear about these type of conditions, they're actually really shocked that that goes on in Illinois. And after that, we had hearings before the Prison Reform Committee of the Illinois House of Representatives, and then we introduced a bill to the Illinois House. And since then, we've continued with the cultural campaign, educating people about TAMS, as well as the political campaign, working on pushing this legislation.
The TAMS Year 10 campaign, who's a part of it, and who's a part of it first?
TAMS Year 10 is a coalition of over 70 different groups and organizations, including mental health advocates, faith groups, public policy groups, prison and reentry groups, and artists and educators. And the people active in the campaign are ex-prisoners who have been released from TAMS and want the public to know what takes place at that prison and what happened to them there, as well as family members. But it's also a tremendous number of concerned citizens who just do not want their taxpayer money being spent on this type of incarceration.
I imagine that most of the folks who are assigned to TAMS, much like that of the demographics of the U.S. prison population generally, are predominantly in communities of, tend to be poor, tend to be of communities of color, African American and Latino. Is that the case with TAMS?
That's right. One of the obstacles to organizing about a supermax prison is that the families of these prisoners are the poorest people in the state of Illinois. And yes, the breakdown at TAMS supermax prison is 55% African American, 25% Latino, and 20% white. It definitely disproportionately affects people of color.
And given the demographics of the state of Illinois, most of those communities of color are centered in and around Chicago. You wouldn't very find a whole lot of them who happen to live in central and southern Illinois. Is that the case?
That's right. Most of the family members and ex-prisoners do come from Cook County, and that's why most of the activism has been in the Chicago area. But there are people from around the state, and there are some family members around the state, and there's certainly groups who are active on the campaign in Carbondale and Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, and other areas in Illinois.
It sounds like a short-term goal is to push forward this legislation to help to at least make more clear-cut the criteria for staying at TAMS. But I imagine that the campaign, even if it were to achieve that, would not want to stop there. What are some of the shorter-term and perhaps longer-term goals of the campaign?
The legislation that we introduced and have been pushing is House Bill 2633, and it establishes transparency, accountability, and standards in determining how prisoners are transferred to and from the supermax. It also prohibits seriously mentally ill people from being housed at the supermax. But Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and many other groups are calling for more humane conditions at TAMS, and our bill does not even address that. It does limit the length of stay to 1 year, but there, you know, are a lot of problems and things to consider about TAMS Supermax that our bill doesn't even address.
And so then some people may say, okay, you're going to treat this kind of like you treat Guantanamo, try to shut it down. Is that maybe a longer-term goal here? Maybe not, or too soon to tell?
There are a lot of different opinions about what to do at or with TAMS Supermax prison, but our campaign's minimum requirement has been that we end psychological torture at TAMS Supermax prison. The way to end psychological torture at the prison is not to keep people in long-term isolation with no ability to communicate with other human beings or have contact with other human beings. So if the Department of Corrections and the governor make changes at TAMS that comply with humane treatment requirements, there isn't really a reason to shut down the prison. The issue is ending psychological torture at the prison.
What are some of, maybe this might be an opportunity now to share, no doubt you've been in contact or your campaign has been in contact with people who have stayed at and probably are still at TAMS. What are some of the stories that they share or tell us, or if there's something you can share right now?
Well, you know, the TAMS Year 10 campaign actually sprang out of an effort called the TAMS Poetry Committee, where we sent mail to all the prisoners in TAMS once a month and exchanged poetry with them and received letters from the prisoners. And they were so shocked that anyone knew about them and that anybody who wasn't directly a family member actually cared about their well-being. And so we have received a lot of testimony and correspondence from the prisoners there. And you know, everyone has a little bit of a different story. There's definitely some prisoners there who are seriously mentally ill and are begging for help and, you know, are really in need of contact. There's other prisoners, including mentally ill prisoners, who have been there an entire decade now. A lot of them want pen pals. they want magazines. We've initiated a magazine program called Supermax Subscriptions. So some of what we do is try to just try to help them kind of cope with the isolation, you know, as best we can through the mail. I can read you testimony from some brief testimony from a couple of the prisoners. One prisoner wrote, "Well, I'm in J-Pod, the mental health pod, so I do have a serious mental health problem. Since I've been in TAMS, I've tried to kill myself twice by slicing my arms wide open. But I've been doing good. No tickets in 3.5 years now. I really miss my family, and sometimes I feel as if I can't go on another day. I've only had one visit from my family because it cost too much to come all this way." That's from Robert, who's been in TAMS since 2003. Here's another one from Joe, who's been in TAMS since 2002. "The CMAX unit," that's the Supermax, "was said to have been designed to house the IDOC's worst of the worst in an effort to help state authorities regain control of their prison system. This couldn't be further from the truth, because most of us have been sent here based merely on the fact that we have mental illnesses or in retaliation for filing lawsuits, grievances, or past disciplinary histories. This facility functions more as a mental institution than a prison of rehabilitation, and it serves no penological purpose other than to warehouse prisoners. As the duration of our isolation drags on and the degree of our conditions of confinement deteriorate, you begin to see the psychological effect that this place has on us. We know that we will spend all day in these cells with absolutely nothing constructive to do with our time, and we do not know if we will ever leave here. This knowledge overwhelms many of us, and it leads many of us to insanity, causing attempted suicide, suicide, body mutilation, hanging, eating and throwing feces, and other extreme acts." And these are really typical letters for us. A lot of the prisoners talk about the other people there who are mentally ill and bang all night and scream all night and smear feces on the wall and put feces in the vents and cut themselves and mutilate themselves. So it's a very distressing situation for the prisoners to live in, and I imagine for the corrections officers also.
For individuals and groups that we want to work with or join with the TAMS Year 10 campaign, what can they do?
First of all, they should sign on as endorsers of the legislation and the campaign, and then they should help activate their groups to sign our petition and be involved in our activities, contact their legislators. We're going to have a lot of events in June and in this summer. Our website is www.year10.org, and we have contact information there.
Those were interviews connected with the controversial TAMS Supermax prison in southern Illinois and a campaign involving community art which worked to raise awareness of the prison. To learn more about the TAMS Year 10 campaign, go online to www.year10.org. That's YEARTEN.ORG. To learn more about mud stenciling, go online to www.mudstencils.com. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.